My pleasure to introduce Glenn Jordan. Glenn is from Northern Ireland and is his second time at Holden and his second week this year. He came back for 2 weeks this year. So that's a good sign, right, Glenn? And hiked to Lyman yesterday and got back at 3 o'clock.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm like, no, that's never going to happen with me. So Glenn is going to lead a discussion this week today, tomorrow, and Friday from 4 to 5:30 in the same location on reflections on Ruth and helping us think through maybe some issues we might have with borders in this country as they do in that country. All I'm going to say is you're in for a treat. I was on the sessions last week. Thank you, Glenn.
Yes, those thinking,
Thank you.
After yesterday, I might end up doing this on a chair, but the old bones have loosened up a bit. Thank you for turning up. This is great, and I'm delighted to be here and delighted to be helping maybe spark a conversation on this old book of the Hebrew Scriptures. Almost a kind of forgotten, a little bit of an obscure book. It occurs occasionally in the lectionary, and people don't really know what to do with it at times. But it's a. We've been doing a little bit of work on the Book of Ruth back home, sparking conversations the length and breadth of Ireland and the United Kingdom. You may have heard we're having a few issues back home with our relationship with the European Union. We call it Brexit. And a couple of years ago, we had a really, really surprising and unexpected election or voting result that nobody anticipated, which has completely changed the landscape of the country and how we think about one another. I'm not sure you would know anything about that, but what it has done is it has raised again a lot of issues that we thought we had buried quite well or we had dealt with and put aside. We're just over halfway through a full decade of centenaries, which began, the celebrations and marking began in 2012. Marking a historic labour strike in Dublin, which marked a whole transition in relationships between the classes in Dublin back in 1912. But then we headed straight into in 1912 there was also a big protest movement of Protestants in Northern Ireland. And the signing of a covenant. Many of the initial signers of this covenant, this public covenant, stating loyalty to Britain and lasting antipathy towards the Republic of Ireland. I think the first 100 signatories on this covenant, and there were tens of thousands of people, Protestants all over the country. Many of the first 100 were clergy, and many signed in blood. We've just passed the centenary of the Great Ulster Covenant. Then we entered into the beginning of the First World War. Then 1916 was the Battle of the Somme, but also in Dublin, depending on which side of the conflict you're on, it was either the rising or it was the rebellion, whether they were rebels or patriots. For Ireland tried to assert independence for the country and was very swiftly and violently put down by the British Army. While at the same time, tens of thousands of young Irishmen volunteered to go fight for the British Army in the First World War. And in 1916, at the Battle of the Somme, tens of thousands of Ulstermen from Northern Ireland and from the South died on the battlefield. And we've just passed those centenaries. And of course, this year, it's the centenary of the ending of, or the armistice that brought the formal hostilities to an end in November 1918. And we'd be marking that centenary in a couple of months. And then we tumble very quickly into a whole series of anniversaries to do with Irish independence and the Declaration of Independence in Ireland, the formation of the first government in Ireland, the awful civil war in Ireland, and followed then by the partition of the country into North and South. So we're in, you layer across the top of that the Brexit deal, and what you have over the last 6 years has been this growing tension levels in the country to do with identity, nationalities, to do with the border on the island, to do with the borders that we build between each other in our communities, the tensions in the relationship between Britain and Ireland, which there's been for centuries, but we had made enormous progress over the years of the peace process, but they've all been resurrected again because of Brexit. And then, of course, the relationships between the UK and Europe, and the prospect that there will be a land border between Europe and the UK on the island of Ireland means the possibility of a reinstatement of the border on the island, which has been gone for over 20 years, which we people fear then will become a focal point for conflict and a renewal of the conflict and the troubles. So we're in an interesting time in the country, culturally, politically, historically, in all sorts of ways. And the thing we found was that faith communities weren't talking about this. It was, these things were too difficult, too complicated. Congregations were too divided. And in two separate conversations late last year, early last year, the Irish government approached us, the organization I work for, Coramila, which is the oldest peace and reconciliation organization on the island. They came and said, look, we're not hearing from people of faith about these border things, about the rising tensions, about Brexit. And then in another conversation with British officials, they said the same thing. Faith communities aren't talking about this. Too divisive, too difficult. We don't know what to do with it. And so we took on to say, we'll see if we can do something. And so we ultimately produced a range of conversation material, Bible study material for faith communities around the Book of Ruth. We were astounded at how this little book of only four chapters speaks so profoundly into our present difficulties. So when the invitation came to Holden, to come to Holden this year, well, I wondered, can we transpose this material into the US? If we drop the Brexit references, is there anything going on in the US at the minute which would resonate with the kind of issues? And I thought last week we'd have a go and see, and I think we decided that there probably was. There are one or two things that are animating your own culture here and your politics and your faith life that maybe the Book of Ruth might speak into as well. So it's been useful stepping aside from all that tumult of the rest of life to come away into the wilderness, retreat from the world, and walk into the embrace of Holden, which holds out the prospect for us of the things that are best in us and the things that are best in you as a people, the warmth and the hospitality and the plain good sense of American people. Or maybe it's just the Midwesterners we're meeting while we're here, or the Minnesotans and the Iowans and the but it's been a good corrective for me, and I hope for participants too. So want to think about borders and about how we approach borders and how we think about borders, and particularly how we think about the people on the other side of those borders. So I've got a little task for you just for 2 or 3 minutes with your neighbor. Hopefully there'll be enough diversity in the room. I certainly think there are enough strange accents in the room. It's amazing to be in a place where you're the only one without an accent. And so for a couple of moments, think about your neighboring states. What stories does your state tell about your neighbors? And what stories do your neighboring states tell about your state? Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'd love to hear some of those stories. So act like what I've asked you to do makes sense, and turn to your neighbor and for 2 or 3 minutes. One more minute. Okay, let me, how do we think about one another? Because, yes, you're different states, but you know that there are different cultures and ideas and traditions and histories connected with your neighbors. Anybody want to volunteer a story that you, tell me what your state is and a story you would tell about your neighboring state? Anybody want to volunteer a story before I conscript somebody? Yeah.
My hometown is in Indiana, and all Hoosiers know that Ohioans are the worst drivers in all 50 states.
Right. Because you have met every driver and you've driven in every other state. Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And the call, where does this come from? Just.
From falsehoods.
Lies.
Sorry.
Yeah.
There's a little truth in every story.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a minute. That's a good one. Yeah. So, okay. Worst drivers, you know, in the history of these United States. Good.
I'm from Ohio.
right. And, well, come on, tell us a story then you have about your neighbors.
Let's see.
Or are you too kind? You people are too good and gentle.
Yeah, Indiana, I guess we see, I'll say Indiana, basketball. Very good basketball players and very great sports fans.
Right. You don't have any nasty stories about Indiana?
Not today.
Good. Are none you're prepared to tell? Good. Any other stories about your neighbors? Yeah.
I'm from Minnesota, and we often are called Minnesota nice, like we are, but it's sort of a backhanded way of saying we're not as good as we are. People, newcomers to the state or even to our city, will say, yeah, people are great. They say, come on over sometime. Do they ever get specific? No.
Right.
Do they have you over to the cabin? No. But they're very friendly about backstabbing.
There was a gentleman last week who was wearing a t-shirt, and that t-shirt was, keep Minnesota passive-aggressive. I thought it was the champion t-shirt of the week. It was great. Yeah, who's this?
I think I think I heard her say Minnesota nice. We say it a different way. We say Minnesotan ice.
Ice.
Oh, right.
A lot of the German and Icelandic or Scandinavian population, which is what we are, keeps to themselves as far as emotional.
Yeah.
Which is it's a kind of reserve. Ice. No.
Yeah. One or two more? Yeah.
I would just piggyback on that saying from the German, my German heritage and mission. If you can't say anything nice, you don't say anything.
So we are nothing.
So very
but
quiet.
I was hard put to think of anything from Michigan and its borders because for us it's Michigan and Michigan because we have the two peninsulas connected by the bridge. They're just as different as they can be, really.
So within the state, there's just in the different peninsulas?
Yeah. So we call them Upers, and they call us trolls because we're below the bridge. But, I mean, the lifestyle and everything is just different.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. So within the, in the same place.
The churches up there, you drive through, they're all Lutheran and Catholic. All of them are. With maybe three exceptions.
Yeah, right.
And because they're ethnically, they were minors. Mm-hmm. So they all came from the same countries. And
Are any of you aware of stories that your neighbors tell about you? Did you want to? Yeah.
My neighbor is from Oregon and I'm from Washington. He was saying that the city across the Columbia River is Vancouver, Washington, and so they base their thinking along what they vote for and do a lot of it, and so he was saying that there's two bridges now that connect the two states. So it used to be just one, but there was so much traffic, they built another one. I think now they're going to build a third one. But he was saying, why don't they vote for mass transit? They keep voting that now.
Right. And, you see...
Oh, I was going to say, I'm from New Jersey, so kind of an outlier here. But a lot of people will say that New Jersey is just a giant suburb of New York, or that we're horrible drivers. All these things. So.
Yes, I've heard those. Well, isn't it interesting how I'm fascinated with within a state, and how there's something in us that, I love the idea that all these drivers are the worst in the whole of the United States. Like, we've loads of evidence for that. Usually by encounter with one or two people and the whole sort, like, I have a thing. Hopefully this isn't being recorded. I have a thing about BMW drivers. Does anybody drive a BMW? And it just seems to be every time I notice a BMW car, the driver's being aggressive. And I think they're all like that. And of course they're not. And so when I came here last year, my brother lives in Redmond, and I told him what I was doing. He said, look, I'm taking a couple of days off. Take my car and, you can park it up at Fields Point. And of course, what was it? And I had to apologize to him. Actually, I said to him when we were messaging back and forth, planning things, I said, I am not being seen behind the wheel of that car. And that was until I saw it, and it was really, really nice. But anyway, I got over my prejudice. Let me deepen this a little bit. Just again for a moment, not to make any particular points, but just to kind of sensitize us to this issue of how we end up, how these stereotypes get a hold of our imagination. I want you to imagine this is a map of the United States, and this is your northern border here, and this is your southern border here. What words do we use to describe people at that northern border, and what words do we use to describe people at the southern border? How do we think about people at either end of our country, of your country? What are the differences? Yeah.
Well, I'm from Michigan. We get lots of contact with Canadians, and we just think they're all nice.
Mm-hmm.
They're that's, like us.
That's
like
just
us.
A synonym.
They're like us. Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
Us being white.
They speak a strange language.
They sorry?
They speak a strange language.
They?
Oh, yeah. Well, they do some French. There's some French, so that's good.
I think they're lucky because they have health care and they have a quieter life.
Yeah.
Fewer population problems. Good attitude towards taking care of drug addicts. I'm jealous of them.
You're jealous of them? Yeah.
But sometimes people here, won't mention any names, but people in high places poke the bear.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they say things that I think are construed to anger and flame, but it's even worse in our southern world.
So what are the words and images we use to describe?
Not very flattering.
Not lazy Mexicans.
Yeah.
But is that the average person, or is that?
Well, I think there's a lot of persuasion when people hear that kind of talk consistently.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed a tremendous difference in how those folks are viewed from places like where I'm from in Michigan, where we have a lot of agriculture and we have a lot of the hospitality industry. We are so dependent on them. And yet when I go to Arizona, those folks seem to have a much more negative and aggressive attitude about the border.
I want us to spend a little bit of time with the Book of Ruth now, just thinking about the people at our borders. Because actually this book, this book deals intently with this issue of borders and our images of the people that live on the other side. I think it'll make sense why we've had this conversation. Let's spend a moment or two. If you've got a Bible, keep it closed. If you've got the text on your phone, turn it off. Because we do a different reading of the first chapter now of Ruth. We're going to see what we can recreate from our memory of the story of Ruth. Just the opening. How does the book open? Anybody remember?
With Naomi.
Eventually, yes. She's not the first person, but she's close up there. What kicks off the book? Does anybody remember?
They go to Moab.
Why do they go to Moab?
Because it's hunger, I think.
It is famine. Yeah. There's a famine in their hometown, which is Bethlehem, interestingly enough. And they flee. Okay, so that's verse one, maybe verse two. Anything else in those early verses before I stick them up on the screen? Anything else that you know you can remember from those early, the scene setters of the book?
The sons marry.
They do. Yep.
A Moabite woman.
They marry women from the country they fled to. And the other thing about, and I'll put it up here and I'll read it quick, just put the first five verses. There's a lot of death in these verses very quickly. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. And after they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. There's a very clearly a famine. Some scholars would also argue that a lot of this death was also to do with war. So you have migrant families certainly in a time of famine, possibly also in a time of war. So great instability. And they move from Judah to Moab. And as I said, death happens very quickly. A couple of things to notice as before we move on. First off is the issue of famine. As the story opens, we are automatically surprised because the famine is in Bethlehem. Now, the famine is linked with Bethlehem. Bethlehem in Hebrew is Bethlehem, which is the house of bread. And so there's a very unusual setting in that there is a famine where there shouldn't be famine. There's a famine in a place that is normal for plenty. The second thing, just to notice as we fly through this, the writer of this story is very keen to tell us about Moab. And three times in these opening five verses, Moab is mentioned. And that should spark some things in our heads. Why Moab? Now, if it's not like they were traveling a great distance, if you imagine that being the Mediterranean coast, and you imagine that being Judah, where Elimelech and his family were living, Moab is right next door. These are two countries that border one another. They have a different culture, but related language, so they can make themselves understood. It's not like they're moving to a completely foreign place. There is some shared culture between the two, a little bit of shared history, actually a lot of history. But somehow or other, Moab appears to Elimelech to be a slightly safer place. Now, why might the writer of the story be interested in talking to us or mentioning this Moab thing? We know at least from the biblical record, we know at least three things about Moab. First of all, we know that you can't trust Moabites, particularly in a time of crisis, particularly if that crisis is related to food. In these two chapters, Deuteronomy 23 and Numbers 22, you have an incredible story when the Israelites are fresh out of Egypt. They're wandering through the desert on the way to their promised land. And they reach a part of this wandering when there is a deep hunger and thirst, a real point of crisis. And they send to the king of Moab for food and water. And the king of Moab gathers his advisors around him and he says, what should we do? And the advisors say, if you give these Israelites anything, they will hoover up everything in the country. So give them nothing. In fact, they said, you should get rid of them quickly. And so the king of Moab refuses their request for food and water. And he also hires a man with his donkey to follow along beside the people and behind the people as they're journeying to curse them as they pass through his land. Now, that kind of history runs really deep. If we were doing this back home in Ireland and you mentioned a great hunger and you mentioned an appeal to another country for help, everybody in the room in 2018, every single person in that room will remember the famine in the 1840s and will remember our appeal to the Parliament in London for support and the fact that they did nothing to help us. And a large element of the particularly anti-English sentiment that has always been around in Irish culture, a lot of it connects into a period like this. That's 150 years ago. And it is still alive. We still talk about supers back home. People who took the soup. Protestant clergy in Ireland almost forced conversions, effectively forced conversions for food. If you became Protestant, if you relinquished your Catholicism, we'll feed you. And so those people who did, who converted, who took the soup, became known as the supers. And it's still used as an insult today. Like, this is from back in the 1840s. So these kinds of stories, however far back in history, have a lasting sting. So you can't trust a Moabite, particularly in crisis, particularly when you're hungry and thirsty. So, of course, when the writer says there was a famine in Bethlehem in the land of Judah, and Elimelech took his wife Naomi and their two sons to Moab, everybody reading the story knows exactly how that's going to end. Second thing we know about Moab is you need to be careful about their women. Because there's another story in Numbers 25 when they're still in the desert wanderings. Moses has been away for a period of time. He comes back into town and there's an orgy happening with Moabite women and Israelite men. And so there is this story that gains currency within the people that Moabite women are sexually voracious. Don't trust your men to Moabite women. They will lead them astray. Now, there is a story in Moab, no doubt. There's a contemporaneous story in Moab, but the people in Israel aren't interested in that story. They've got this one. Watch your men when Moabite women are about. And so when the writer writes the story and he says, and the two boys met Orpah and Ruth and fell in love and got married, everybody in Israel reading the story knows how that's going to end. Because we know what Moabite women are like. And the third thing we know is, actually, as a people, you just can't trust them. As a people. Every one of them. They're not just bad drivers. Every one of these people are untrustworthy. They have salacious roots and their moral character is to be questioned. And we know that again in the biblical record because of how they began. There's a story, you know, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cities on the plain are destroyed and Lot and his wife and two daughters escape from the city and they're making their way across the plain and his wife dies and they find refuge in a cave. And from the perspective of that cave, as they look across the plains and everything's burning, from the perspective of Lot and his two daughters, the world has ended. There's nobody left. And the two daughters, they make the jump in the logic that says, effectively, we're the only three people who have survived this. And if we don't do something about this, the whole human race is finished. So this is what I'm going to do. Tonight, the oldest one says, I'm going to get dad drunk. And then I'm going to sleep with him and get pregnant. And then to the younger daughter, you do it tomorrow night. And you get pregnant. And that way we can keep the human race going. And that's what happens. And the first child born is named Moab. And so, as far as Israel is concerned, these people were born out of incest. They're nasty people. And actually, even their name, Moab, it sounds like the Hebrew Ma'avi, which means of my father. And so even the name they have for these people is a vocal insult, a constant reminder of what they're like and where they came from. These are people not to be trusted. These are people you have nothing to do with. And Elimelech brings his family to these people. Now, the writer doesn't have to do anything else, because in these five verses, the writer has set up the scenario and he can rely on all the background information that will be in the heads of the readers or the hearers. These are people you have nothing to do with. Now, just, I'm not going to ask answers to this. Some of the things we know about them, whoever they may be, in your contemporary setting. People you can't trust. Perhaps because of history, perhaps because of stories that have been heard and passed around. About the questionable ethics and morals of those individuals. And how women are often the target for that. About how we can tar a whole nation or a whole group of people with stories that suit our purposes over against them. Again, without wanting to discuss this, we all know who they are. I suspect every country has a they. That a they who have been created, an other, others who have been created by history, by story, by legend, by prejudice, by fear. And here in just five verses, the writer of the story of Ruth is exploiting all of that presumed knowledge. This is a process that we call stereotyping. The word was mentioned here a moment ago. That we stereotype groups of people, how we pick a characteristic about an individual or about or a story we've heard, a particular characteristic which we blow up out of all proportion. And then the complexity of a human being is compressed down into this characteristic. They're not trustworthy. They're lazy. They're immoral. They're bad drivers. And a whole person is collapsed down, a whole group of people can be collapsed down into this characteristic. And we ignore individual differences, we ignore the subtleties and complexities of human identity and our common humanity. We ignore the fact that they have the same joys and pleasures as we do, because it doesn't fit in with the characteristic, with the stereotype we have created. When we match that stereotype to our fears, and we make it cruel, then anything is possible. And we can quickly move from simply estrangement into violence. And it happens remarkably quickly, and it happens even amongst the most otherwise sensible and respectable people. We demonize that individual or that group of people. We assume malign intent on their part. Comments like, they intended to cause the harm that we experienced. They were deliberate. They knew what they were doing, and they intended to hurt us. And we grow a sense of distrust. Everything, every idea, everything they say is wrong. Or they're proposing that idea for some kind of dishonest purpose. We externalize a sense of guilt then, because everything bad that happens to us is their fault. It doesn't matter that I've made a mess of the economy here because of decisions I've made. It must be their fault. It must be the Mexicans. Or it must be the Muslims. Or it must be the British back home. We Irish have no fault in this matter at all. The guilt is externalized. It's their fault. And we attribute evil to them. They want to destroy us. And they want to destroy what we value the most about our culture, about our history, about our freedoms. And therefore they must be destroyed themselves, because they represent a fundamental threat to who we are. And so, everything becomes a zero sum. Everything that benefits them harms us. And everything that benefits us harms them. Paranoia. Any criticism of us or praise of them is disloyal and treasonous. You can't stand, you can't identify, you can't speak positively about them because of the threat. In the current environment, can anybody say anything positive about Russia? Because anything positive about them is treasonous towards us, because they want to undermine Europe. So they interfered in the Brexit vote. They want to undermine your democracy. So they possibly interfered in your election 2 years ago. Any criticism of us or praise of them is disloyal and treasonous. And then all neutrality ends. Sorry, we prejudge people. Everybody in the enemy camp is an enemy. There can be no standing with them. There can be no advocacy for them. If you're siding with them, you are an enemy. You are our enemy as well. Because anyone who is not for us is against us. And the lines are being drawn, and the borders are being drawn and becoming harder and more firm and more black and white, because that suits our project. There is no empathy. We have nothing in common with them. And considering them human is actually dangerous. We cannot then, we isolate them and us, we separate. We cannot dialogue, negotiate, cooperate, or resolve our conflicts in any way. And then what we've created is a situation in which violence becomes permissible, sometimes even required, because their evil and their threat to us makes it permissible for us to act in a hostile way towards them. And if they were given the chance, they'd do the same to us. And so the book of Ruth starts off with these simple verses and exploits the already existing ideas that are in the heads of the readers about these people. You don't go there when you're hungry. You don't have anything to do with their women. If we build any sort of connection or any sort of relationship with them, we will be corrupted by them. Thing is, the book of Ruth, as it proceeds then, knocks us backwards. Because Elimelech and his wife go to Moab in a famine and completely unsettling the prejudged story we have in here, Elimelech and his family find a home there. They find a welcome. They find hospitality in their time of need. Nobody imagined ever that was ever possible from a Moabite. Not only that, the two boys find wives. And there's a long and established married relationship with those women. Even after the death of the two men, the text later records that they stayed loyal to those men even after their death. The simple thing, those women would be entitled to claim back from Naomi the kind of contract sum that would have exchanged hands between the two fathers for the marriage. When that marriage ended without children, you get your dowry back. But Naomi was already destitute. And it appears that these Moabite women, nobody can trust. Out of sympathy or love or commitment, but some form of empathy for Naomi, didn't claim back what they deserved. And so in a sense, they acted as if their husbands were still alive and remained faithful to their memory. And so we are instantly knocked back in the story. Things are not happening as we would have expected them to happen. The writer has created space for a different story to emerge, one that we weren't expecting. Let me stop there for a moment to find out if that's kind of making sense. This is the kind of foundation for what comes in the rest of the story, for how it unfolds. And we're going to look in the next two sessions at how the rest of the story unfolds. But this is our foundation to realize that from the beginning, we are on the back foot. So that's a cricketing term. That maybe doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. But from the very beginning, we are knocked a little bit sideways because the story is not unfolding as we would want it to. And it creates the possibility for us to hear something different about people we've already established an opinion on. Any comments or questions on that, or reflections on that in your own context? Good, well, we'll go on then. We move on.
Well, I don't know if this is what you mean, but we've been hearing some wonderful stories of our DACA students that are here threatened with expulsion. You know, they've lived here a long time, they've gone to college, they want to be doctors, they want to be a part of our society.
Yeah.
So when they tell their stories, it forces us to confront our...
The DACA example, I think that's a brilliant example. Did the news reach here of the Malian student in Paris a couple of months ago who scaled the outside of a building to rescue a child? Ah, really fascinating story. He was waiting. He had made an application for refugee status. He had arrived illegally in the country, I think, and it was being processed and. But his status was uncertain. He performs this heroic act, saving this child. First of all, the mayor of Paris comes out and says, can we really deny citizenship to a person like this? And then the president, Macron, steps in and this guy is fast-tracked as an example of the kind of people. So it raises the stories help raise the possibility of how do you belong? Who is one of us? Now, they're complex and there's layers to these things. But ultimately, this story and the stories we're talking about here are stories about how do you become one of us? Or how do we deal with the question of welcome and hospitality? What's our responsibility in this? So the DACA one is good. And those stories are hugely important. I want to say a little bit about stories and storytelling in a moment. Any other comments or questions or reactions to this text? Nobody really knows when the Book of Ruth was written. One of the strong theories is that it was written after the return from exile. So maybe just so that everybody's kind of on the same page, you know, that there was Israel, and then with the civil war it split in two, and there was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and they all went along with their own setups for a long time, and then the northern kingdom was destroyed by colonizing power, an empire, and people were scattered all over the place. Sometime later, that empire was overrun by a bigger empire, the Babylonians, and they also took into their ambit the southern kingdom. And they colonized in a different way, and they took the brightest and the best from the southern kingdom and brought them to Babylon. And after a period of time, Babylon was destroyed by another kingdom, another empire, and then that empire let them return to their country. They came back, many of them came back with these great visions of what it was going to be like when they got back and how they would restore the fortunes of the nation and the city. You know, you might imagine they would have a campaign slogan that would be "Make Israel Great Again." And when they come back, they come back to a country that it's still pretty destroyed after the devastation of conquest. Not much has changed over the years they've been away. And so everybody's conscious of a country, of a nation, of a people, if you like, who have fallen away from the previous heights they imagined they had. We used to be this. We used to have this kind of wealth. Remember the stories we told about Solomon, and remember the stories we heard from our grandparents about the glories of the temple. We were a force to be reckoned with in the world, but now look at us. Look how far we've fallen. And there were various people being blamed for this decline in the nation. But what you did have were competing visions back home for how to make Israel great again, how to restore the fortunes of the country. And the blame, as I said, was lying in different ways, in different places. One of those visions would have been with people like the followers of Ezekiel, the prophet, and some of the other prophets as well. They put the blame for the national decline on the fact that the people had deserted God. This was a spiritual crisis primarily. And so these people came back into the political ferment of making this great again. And they came back with a vision that said, stop building infrastructure, stop building your homes. If we are going to make the nation great again, the first thing we need to do is we need to build a temple. Let's rebuild the temple, and then God will be pleased with us, and then all these other greatness will be restored. We will be what we once were. But there were other guys and other political groups, and I may be associated with people like Ezra and Nehemiah. They had a different political vision. Actually, there's a part of their political vision for the restoration of the greatness of Israel, which was to do with ethnicity. For them, the problem was too much mixing of the races. We don't actually know anymore who's an Israelite. So if we're going to make the nation great again, then we need to restore ethnic purity in the land. So all you Israelite men who have married foreign women, you must divorce them. And in both the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah, you find incredible violence being executed against women, foreign women who were married to Israelite men. And men who resisted this happening were beaten, and you know that women being dragged by their hair out of the city of Jerusalem. I mean, horrendous violence being perpetrated against these so-called foreign women, who obviously by that stage had been in that part of the world for a long time. Yet to make Israel great again, we need to restore ethnic purity. We need to put the foreign thing away from us. Now there are one or two other kinds of visions that are exercised out there, but these are two of the strong ones. And I don't think, well, both of our contexts, back home in Ireland, in UK and Europe, and here in the US, we are experiencing unprecedented political and cultural turmoil in both our homes. Don't think for a moment that Israel, after the exile, was any less of a furnace of political ideology and vision, and competing vision and conflict. Actually, I think the kind of circumstances we find ourselves in today, it wouldn't surprise me to find huge parallels between our contexts and what was going on. The thing that fascinates me about the book of Ruth is that an artist steps into the context and tells a story. Now, frankly, the least interesting question about this book is whether it's true or not. I'm not remotely interested in whether this is true. There are lots of ways for something to be true. This is a true story because it speaks into a particular context with great clarity and insight. And it says to people like Ezekiel, struggling with vision of restoring a kind of religious purity again, here's a story. Maybe it's a tale, maybe it's a legend, but here's a story from our own culture about a Moabite woman. Can you genuinely say that the only thing that's great, that the only way we can be great is if we all worship in the same way? That there is some kind of religious template? Now, people will say, of course, the great promise that Ruth makes to Naomi, your land will be my land, your people, my people. Where you go, I will go. Your God will be my God. That's not a conversion. That's actually a promise made by one woman to another. Look, whatever it takes. Who's this your God is again? Look, if it means when I moved countries, I have to pick up the God of that country, that's fine. I'll do that because of my commitment to you. That statement by Ruth is more about her loyalty to Naomi than it is to any religious conversion. And certainly when she's in the country, we can, if you read the story, she's never allowed to forget the fact she's a Moabite. In fact, there's one exchange between Boaz, one of the characters who comes in later, and his field manager, And Boaz notices this young woman in the field. And he says to his field manager, who's that? Oh, he says, that's Ruth the Moabite from Moab. That's like saying, you know, oh yeah, he's Glenn. He's the Irishman from Ireland. You don't need to, unless that's a critical aspect of our identity. You just are not allowed to forget the fact you're a Moabite. You're a Moabite. And all the time through the text, Ruth the Moabite. Ruth the Moabite. And likewise, when it comes to Ezra and Nehemiah and their vision of ethnic purity for the land, the story ends with a genealogy in which the child that comes into the marriage between Ruth and Boaz is placed in the line of King David. And so this storyteller invites us into the prospect that, forcing us to think about the greatest period in our history, about our greatest king, and then scandal of all scandals, he says, he had foreign blood, you know. Even our best king, our most famous king, wasn't a pure blood Israelite. But the storyteller, by setting us up in the way he does in those early verses, then begins to unpack a story in which our stereotypes are confounded. The story of Ruth enters into this political furnace as a counter-narrative to the narratives that prevail at the time, and says there is another way of thinking about this. There are other possibilities out there. We don't have to be locked into this narrative. There is another story. There is an alternative for us. And so, in the famine, in the place of bread, and inhospitable, untrustworthy neighbors, everything's turned round. We should have had plenty here and we had nothing. But we found a welcome in Moab. We found faithful women in Moab. We found a culture willing to take us in and offer us hospitality. And out of that came something surprising. The challenge, I think, for us as people of faith in our particular cultures today, in the ferment that our countries are undergoing, is what is there in our faith life and our practice which assists us in telling a compelling counter-narrative to what dominates the airwaves round about us? And we're going to pick this question up a bit more tomorrow when we look at the role of liturgy as storytelling, and we look at the role of art and memory. And but our challenge is not to be so swayed by the stories that are told outside that we lose hope, but to find ways in which we can find a counter story which restores hope in us and builds hope and resilience in our communities. I want to close with, in each of these sessions, out of a conviction that that the arts have a powerful role for us, as this storyteller in Ruth had in his day or her day, that in our day too, our storytellers, our poets, our songwriters and our playwrights and our novelists, filmmakers, musicians, have an important role in helping us reimagine. I want to come back to a border again with a poem. I'm going to invite you to listen to the poet Naomi Shihab Nye has a... I'll let her explain it. And I'd be interested in what this poem stirs up in you about.
Cross That Line is an important poem to me because I loved Paul Robeson so much as a child. I loved his voice. We had a record of him singing. And, you know, I wouldn't read his biography till I was an adult and know about what he suffered as a so-called communist and how his passport was taken away from him and he was not allowed to leave the nation, though he had a huge fan club in Europe and elsewhere. So I thought this was so funny when he did this. And I now own a CD of this concert.
Really?
Yeah, someone sent it to me. That is some archival recording. Pretty amazing.
Wow.
Cross That Line. Paul Robeson stood on the northern border of the USA and sang into Canada, where a vast audience sat on folding chairs waiting to hear him. He sang into Canada. His voice left the USA when his body was not allowed to cross that line. Remind us again, brave friend, what countries may we sing into? What lines should we all be crossing? What songs travel toward us from far away to deepen our days?
What lines of the poem strike you, jump out at you, hook into you? It's a terrific image. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's an astonishing thing. Apparently, I believe he had a big following amongst Welsh miners. I'm going to be like Ruth the Moabite from Moab, but Welsh miners in Wales. Apparently, he sent them money during a period of a difficult strike, and so they loved him. And again, he wasn't allowed to travel. He wasn't allowed to cross to Wales to do a concert for the, so they did it over the phone. He sang into a phone here, and that was broadcast to a gathering in Wales. There are always ways of crossing the line, even if someone or something wants to deny us the right to do that, or doesn't want us to cross the line, there is always a way to cross the line. What other?
I like the folding chairs.
Oh, who's that?
Right here.
Why?
Because they're temporary and uncomfortable, and you can imagine that they're sort of just like set up in a hurry, taken down in a hurry.
Brilliant. And you will go through that discomfort. Because I get the feeling that this isn't just like a gig that people turn up to. This is a this is an act of political protest to sit on those uncomfortable chairs. It's an act of defiance. It's a fabulous thing. Anything else that jumps at you from these lines?
I think just the image of getting the idea, oh, well, what I could do is stand on them, like, really? I love that because it is an unusual way to cross the line.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a really dramatic act, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Of line crossing and of border crossing. It's creative, it's imaginative. And how do the authorities stop that?
Yeah, and it flies in the face of those who said, no, you may not do a different way.
You know, the only way to stop that really is for the powers to expose themselves. And some act of violence that is required to shut that down. But in the doing of that, as I said, the powers, they expose themselves for what they are. Yes, there's a reciprocal movement here. What lines should we be crossing? What are the lines out there that are proximate to us that we need to step across? But there's an alternative movement as well. There is the movement towards us. What is it that the other side of that line has to offer us? I think it's just so important that we're thinking about these things this week here at Holden. And we're thinking about religious diversity and cultural diversity and interfaith conversations. It's because it's not just about, you know, there's a sense in which we can be paternalistic about this. But there's a recognition, I think, in this poem that this is reciprocal. That this relationship moves both ways. What songs travel towards us from the other side of that line that will serve to deepen our experience? What is it? What is the blind spot that we travel with that can only be revealed to us through encounter with the other? If we stay on our side of the line, if there is no journeying towards, if there is no movement, what line should we be crossing? What space are we creating for the reciprocal movement? What do we need from the other? We don't hold all the cards in this conversation here. We only understand of God what God has chosen to reveal to us. We don't understand God in his or her entirety. There are blind spots that others can deepen for us, can reveal for us. And this idea, it's okay, his body could cross the line, but his voice left. Because this is not just a work for those who are young and reckless and energetic and passionate, and all you old people, you know, there is a place for all of us in this act of defiance, in crossing the line. Let's be quiet for a moment. And just let just settle with your thoughts. What is it that the Spirit is troubling the waters with in your heart, in your mind, in your spirit? What is the word of challenge or comfort? Coming from this simple book. What lines should we all be crossing? Good. Amen. We'll pick it up exactly at that point tomorrow, and hope to see you again. Thank you for participating so well.